You're listening to a Frequency Podcast Network production.
Whether you use an iPhone or an Android, you're no doubt familiar with the annoyance of needing the right power cord to charge it. Did you bring your Samsung phone to an iPhone friend's house? Well, tough luck. So that's a small problem, only it's not, really. The same intent that created Apple's proprietary Lightning charger exists today in almost every industry. Imagine you're a farmer and you need to purchase the right brand of thresher to attach it to your tractor, or you're a software company and you need to make four different versions of the exact same app in order to get it on every platform. Or imagine you're just a person who is sick of using Twitter or X and wants to bring their followers to another social media network. Good luck with that. If a company can lock you into their platform with software or hardware or anything else, they will. Why wouldn't they? If you could force your customers to pay a huge cost in either time or money for choosing to go elsewhere, you'd probably do it too. It is only now that parts of the world are waking up to the dangerous precedent this sets. Welcome to the fight for interoperability. It starts with things like a lightning cable, but it goes a lot deeper than that. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. This is The Big Story. Anthony Rosbrough is an assistant professor of law and computer science at Dalhousie University, as well as a doctoral researcher in law at the European University Institute. Hey, Anthony.
Hi, Jordan. How are you?
I'm doing really well. And my first question for you is, we're about to have a very techie, IP-based, you know, internet-type conversation. Why are we starting it with me asking you about farming equipment?
Well, it's important to understand that agricultural equipment and machinery is heavily computerized. And so when we talk about tech and IP issues, those issues also heavily impact farmers and innovators in that space. And so an issue has come to light in recent years where farmers are experiencing a reduction in choice of the equipment that they can buy. And Canadian innovators who are designing and building technologies in this space are finding it difficult to make their products work alongside the bigger manufacturers' stuff.
Give me an example or two of what that looks like practically. Like, what are farmers dealing with?
You know, farmers will often purchase what's called an implement. So this would be an attachment to an existing larger piece of equipment. So you can think of a modern farming combine as like a KitchenAid stand mixer, and different things will plug into it and allow it to perform different functions. And this is the case also for tractors, which often tow something behind it. And the choice of what you can buy that would work with your existing tractor or combine is can be limited by the kind of data protocols or the sensors and data flows that connect between those two devices.
Uh-huh.
You can think of it as speaking to one another. So they kind of share a language, and there's increasing difficulty in getting those two devices to speak to one another.
Why does farming equipment need to be that complex in the first place? And I say this as somebody whose family goes back generations of farming and, you know, remember my grandfather or even just my dad, you know, hooking things up very practically to tractors and attaching them physically. And like, there was never a computer on board. What's the advantage there?
Well, you know, the important thing to remember is that agricultural technologies have really been a source of immense innovation for most of human history. You know, starting with purely manual tools, horse-drawn tools, steam engine, internal combustion engines. And so I think it's important for us to understand that agriculture has probably been the single most consistent driver of innovation over the course of human history.
Uh-huh.
And that has involved a lot of increasing mechanical complexity. So the machines that you probably remember seeing and interacting with were probably mechanically complex. But gradually what's happened is also an increase in electrical sensors and computerization. Sometime in the late 70s, you know, agricultural equipment began incorporating more and more computerized components. And the basis for that, the reason, is really for efficiency and monitoring. You know, farmers don't just plant crops, walk away, and wait until harvest. Running a modern farm involves incredible amount of data and keeping track of things. It's important for not just, you know, protecting the yields of what's produced on the farm, but also for financial purposes and, you know, fertilizer use. So digitization in agriculture gives a lot of the same benefits as it does in other contexts. So it increases accuracy and efficiency. And you could absolutely run a farm with a horse-drawn plow in 2024, but your yields probably would be much lower and it would be not probably economically viable.
And of course, I guess with digitization for these companies comes the opportunity to lock their users down, for want of a better term.
Yeah, in some ways, locking users in.
Right.
If you're the producer of the primary platform, whether it's the tractor or the combine, and you can use computerization or a data format to prevent third-party components from working with that machine, then in some ways, you're forcing the farmer or the producer to purchase only your products or your components. And that's a real source of concern from a competition perspective, but also from a food security perspective. That we want to have a choice in the marketplace for the tools of agriculture, because that's important so that we can all eat, which I think most people do.
Maybe you could zoom out now. This phenomenon, I guess, is termed interoperability. And we started with farming equipment because it seems like an interesting place to start, but this is everywhere. What does this term mean? And literally, like, in the big picture, what's at stake here?
Yeah, so interoperability, if you were to, you know, enter it into a Google search bar, what you would probably get is a description about purely, you know, software situations, two programs working together. So to get Google Chrome to work on your iPhone requires a certain degree of interoperability to take place. It means that, you know, two distinct platforms can exchange and make use of data mutually. And what we're seeing sort of increasingly where computers are being adopted and incorporated into more and more things, is that this interoperability concern is not just purely at the program level anymore. It's now at the device and physical technology level. Increasingly, we've also seen in terms of the marketplace that there's kind of just a handful of very large technology companies that are kind of building the platforms on which we all rely for our work, our life. And so if there's a certain amount of lock-in that is sort of comes with that platform effect of an economy driven by just a few companies, what's at stake, I guess, is a loss of innovation, a loss of consumer choice, and, you know, increased costs, and really a concentration of power in the hands of just a few companies. And I think we should be all concerned about that for one reason or another.
Before we talk about the fight over this aspect, we've also covered right to repair on this show before. Is interoperability similar or a little bit different? And if so, how so?
Yeah, so there's definitely a common source of concern for repair and interoperability. I mean, they're both concerned with access to software. So obviously, in order to fix a lot of these devices, we need to have access to the software that is necessary to diagnose or to force a kind of authentication when the device rejects an independent repair. And there's countless cases where we see that is a kind of technique used by manufacturers to prevent independent repair.
Mm-hmm.
From interoperability, the same kind of software access is needed to what you might call force interoperability, or to engage in sometimes called reverse engineering, but a kind of diagnosis and understanding how a device works so that you can develop third-party peripherals or components. So there's a common root to the problem, but the policies kind of end up taking a different shape. You know, and with repair, we're often talking about sustainability and extending product lifespan. With interoperability, we're talking more so about fair competition and giving independent innovators the chance to develop things that work with existing platforms.
In terms of Canada, and we will widen this lens shortly, but what kind of rules or regulations are in place to prevent companies from locking in their users and not letting them use other companies' add-ons or devices with them?
You know, it's a difficult question because it really depends on how they are preventing that sort of interoperability from taking place. So generally, I mean, the biggest source of rules that would stand in the way of companies doing this would come from competition law, from Canada's Competition Act. But, you know, we've seen over the last couple of decades a kind of lack of willingness for the Competition Bureau in Canada to really weigh in these situations. And in some ways, the Canadian lawmakers are kind of relying on these details being figured out south of the border in sort of the U.S. context, and sort of hoping that by the time these products and services reach Canada, that some degree of market fairness has been already figured out for us.
Mm-hmm.
But I think where there's a need for policymakers to direct their attention is to think about how Canadian competition policy should be looking at this much more closely. There's technically an opportunity under the consumer protection law, which is generally within the realm of provinces jurisdiction, to do something on this issue as well. But I think that the starting point is really under competition law, and we need a greater emphasis and focus on this issue in Canada.
To use a real-world example of one issue like this that has at least been resolved, I think one that many people might have heard about involves Apple and the cords that are used to charge its iPhone. Can you just walk us through that one and how it eventually ended?
Yeah, so anyone who's used an Apple device in the last 10 years or so would know that there's often proprietary cables and connectors. So the Lightning cable is one example, if you recall that.
Mm-hmm.
And Apple's not alone in this use of proprietary interfaces for their devices. And Europe sort of took a stance on this in 2022 and passed a directive requiring a common charging solution for consumer devices. And they sort of settled on USB should be the standard. And so that's now implemented in the European Union. And from this year, 2024 onwards, consumer devices have to use USB-C as a common charging solution. So it's not necessarily ended in the sense of in a global sense. Like this remains, you know, an option certainly for manufacturers who use different formats and protocols outside of the EU. But certainly that kind of leadership will have a kind of global effect, one would think, over time.
Why is Europe typically so far ahead of us when it comes to these kind of technology regulations and laws?
There's a few reasons for that. So one is that, you know, the EU operates under a different legal and political framework than Canada or the United States. And its primary purpose is really to harmonize the laws and regulations of its member states. So that's a bit different than the federal context in Canada, right? Where we have a split jurisdiction between the federal government and the provinces.
Right.
And so the legal basis for the EU's existence is really to create a single market. And that's the primary purpose. And that generally leads to more centralized regulation in some areas. And there's also, I guess, on the other hand, some cultural reasons for this. So the countries that comprise the EU generally have more cultural acceptance of government regulation than maybe the free market traditions in the US and Canada, and even the UK to some extent.
Has the push in the European Union galvanized any lawmakers in North America, I'll include the United States in this as well, to consider taking action on this? I mean, it's one thing for a global company like Apple to make this change because of the EU law, because it's probably just simpler for them to have one cord. But there are tons of devices that are primarily used and manufactured in North America that aren't protected by this. What is the state of that movement here?
I think that the EU's kind of bold action on something as seemingly benign as a common charging cable for a consumer device has started to, you know, inspire competition and antitrust authorities in both Canada and the US to kind of look at these issues with greater scrutiny. So we saw just last week, the Federal Trade Commission in the United States announced that it was conducting an investigation into Apple's anti-competitive practices with the iPhone.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of details there that we still have to learn and see, you know, how that's going to shake down. But I think competition and antitrust are increasingly now on the radar of policymakers. And I don't know if we can trace that back specifically to the EU's decision to force a common charging cable. But I think the EU's leadership to kind of just go ahead and regulate in areas where, you know, the United States or Canada sometimes tread lightly. I think that bold leadership has been kind of contagious. I don't know if necessarily we'll see the same requirements for a common charging cable, for example, in Canada, but I think we will see more action on similar files that are probably even more important.
As someone who understands the ramifications of opening up kind of firewalled ecosystems, make the case to me for the company's point of view to do this, or is it just so much more economically advantageous to lock everything up? Like, there are advantages to opening this ecosystem, right?
Yeah, well, you know, I know we started the conversation talking about agricultural technologies, but let's stick with, you know, consumer devices as an example. And I think the big argument would be to add value to the brand and the product itself through interoperability. I mean, when we have a greater degree of interoperability with a product, that makes it more useful and that gives it more value. So if we take a look at Apple's what's called its interface accessory protocol. So this is a communication system between an Apple device and any accessory that you use. So whether that be your car, for example, That's what allows third-party developers to make applications and devices compatible with an iPhone, for example. And Apple generally licenses that protocol and charges fees for using it. And it's a huge source of revenue for the company. It makes the company money. It makes the phone more useful and greater context, and it adds value to the brand and the product. So I think there's a win-win here by having a greater degree of openness. And if you look at the history of like the USB, I'm talking about the original USB cable. You know, that platform was created by 6 different competing technology companies at the time, IBM and Microsoft, and folks got together with competing market interests and decided that, you know, a common standard was in their market interests. So I think it's wrong for us to think that the only ways to kind of win at the innovation game is through a closed model of exclusive proprietary formats. I think history shows us that openness is what gives things value and makes things useful. And so that would be my argument to the companies.
Last question, a practical one for Canadians encountering this now, be they farmers or people playing with new pieces of technology. What are their options when they realize that their system has locked them in? Is there a complaint to the Competition Bureau? Is it like switch platforms if you don't like it? Like, what's possible at the moment?
Well, I think obviously the best course of action is at the starting end is to think about, you know, at the time of making a decision to purchase, you know, looking for those technologies, those devices that have sort of, you know, been built on an open source philosophy.
Right.
Even if, you know, they contain proprietary components, like making sure that interoperability is part of the purchase decision, I think is an important consideration. But as for, you know, what happens to someone who's discovered that they've been locked in and they've already committed to the purchase, I think you can make a complaint to the Competition Bureau, absolutely. And I don't think that that's without effect or value. But I think ultimately this is an area where we need collective resistance from everyday people and companies who are looking to do business and develop their own solutions to things that, you know, we risk losing Canadian innovation and jobs. And I think we should be having this conversation kind of in a broader kind of national policy kind of perspective that, you know, this is an opportunity for us, I think, to speak to our local MPs. I know that's cliche to say, but I think this is an issue that needs more attention, that we can't sort of go ahead with a reality where things are becoming more and more concentrated and we have less and less choice. I mean, that's in no one's interests. And I think it's just something we have to speak up about.
Anthony, thank you so much for this. Really illuminating, and I understand this all a lot better now.
Thanks so much.
Anthony Rosbro of Dalhousie University. That was The Big Story. For more from us, you can head to thebigstorypodcast.ca. It displays the same way on any browser, on any operating system. You can also offer us some feedback. We'd love to hear from you. The easy way to do that is via email, hello@thebigstorypodcast.ca. The slightly harder but still very easy way to get in touch is via phone. The number is 416-935-5935, and you can call us and leave a voicemail. The Big Story is available, as I said, in every podcast platform. We are the kings of interoperability. You can even just listen to us via a browser on the website if you don't want to download an app. Thanks for listening. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. We'll talk tomorrow.